So Sarah Atfield is going first, working class academic and writer from London, now living and working in Sydney, Australia, University of Technology in Sydney, and working on theater pieces for the Sydney Fringe Festival. The second speaker is Lisa Valestra, a doctoral candidate in English and American Literature at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, and her research interests include 19th and 20th century American literature, multi-ethnic and queer, women's literature, American and working class studies. Sherry Lee Lincoln is the third speaker, professor of English and American Studies at Jonestown State, where she co-directs the Center for Working Class Studies, widely published on working class culture, deindustrialization, and pedagogy, and editor of the weekly blog, Working Class Perspectives, and was the founding president of the Working Class Studies Association. Our final speaker is Tim Libretti, professor of English at Northeastern Illinois University. The speakers will keep to 15 minutes, and that will leave us time for discussion at the end. So, Sarah.
Sorry for the delay, I was clapping with the technology, but you've got to have music, so. And I've given some sheets out with the lyrics, because I'm pretty sure that nobody will understand the accent of the artist. No offense, but. Are there any extras of the sheets? UK grind, which is a music form from London, and the expression of working class culture. So, music, literature, yeah, same thing. Just in case you're wondering. UK grime artists such as Dizzy Rascal, Lethal Bizzle, Kano, Wiley, and Lady Sovereign create music that often deals explicitly with their experiences as working class youth. Their songs contain stories of hardship, racism, gang culture, clashing with authority, and so on, but are also testament to the empowering effects of creativity, as the artists also speak of the ways in which music has helped to keep them out of trouble and to find a voice. UK Grind is also a celebration of working class vernacular, as the artists sing and rap in their working class accents and demonstrate the richness and variety of particularly the London Argo, which has evolved and inflected with accents and words from Caribbean and South Asian migrants. UK grime artists, I think, are serving an important purpose in working class communities, as their messages about the empowering effects of creativity are heard and acknowledged by other young people. And because the music is created to appeal to young people, I mean, that's good, the socially conscious lyrics are then able to reach widely and influence. So an examination of some of these UK grime artists shows how young working class people are able to express themselves on their own terms and find ways to tell their stories and connect with other young people who have also been disaffected and marginalised. UK grime is a relatively recent style of music. Has its roots in hip-hop, UK garage and dancehall, and it emerged from the public housing estates of East London in the early 2000s, so it's pretty recent. Distributed mainly through pirate radio stations such as Rinse FM and Roar FM and a few others, set up in apartments and garages literally, and popular mostly among working class youth. The majority of the artists are male and black, but the music speaks to black and white, but to council estate kids, so public housing kids. Council estate is a term I'm using now. Grime's an offshoot of jungle and is a minimal electronic dance music with, and I'm quoting it from some musos here, queasy bass lines, off-center rhythms, aggressive beats, and rapping. It's faster than most hip-hop and is verbose and manic. Now, I came across this music a while ago when I heard about Lethal Bizzle, or Lethal B, who hails from the same estate as me, and that's Chinchmore estate, that's a little bit of it, a high-rise public housing estate in North East London where I grew up. And I like the sound of this music, I think it just sounds really cool. And I was already interested in hip-hop, and I'd done some work in Australian hip-hop. And I love a heavy bass line, quite a fan of that. And this music also has a reggae dub influence as well. But I was really drawn to the lyrics. Lethal was singing, that's not his real name, by the way. I remember his real name, it wasn't like Graham. Lethal was singing, rapping about experiences on the estate, encounters with police, stealing cars, everyday events that occur in this kind of environment. And although I haven't lived on the estate for a long time, my mother still lives there, so I feel, you know, still feel very connected with it. This is music to dance to, it gets your body moving, which is, because of the heavy bass especially, it's really hard to sit still when you've got a really heavy bass. And the electronic elements of the music create an immersive effect, so it's a lot of repetition and looping as well in the instrumental part. But unlike other types of dance music, grime has a message. The rapping is generally socially conscious, and despite the growing success of some of the artists, such as Dizzy Rascal, the artists have something to say, and the kids on the estate are listening. And I believe very strongly in the power and effects of creativity. And if I'm realistic about it, I know there are limits to how much an artist can do in terms of preventing violent crime and other effects of living in poverty. I also think that something like grime provides young people on the estate an outlet for creative expression. And finding a voice and being able to tell your stories on your own terms can help young people to find alternatives to the violence and crime that is part of life on the estate. And that's certainly the case with Lethal Bizzle, Wiley and Dizzy Rascal. These artists, they acknowledge the criminal behaviour they were involved in before they took to making music. And they talk about how the music was a way out of that ghetto mentality. They didn't necessarily leave the neighbourhoods, but the mentality of the ghetto that kind of left that behind. And although they're becoming quite successful, some of these people, they seem, at least so far, quite grounded and connected to the places they grew up in. And look, you know, they've got the look. You know, there's a bit of posture in there. And there's a bit of booty shaking in some of their video clips. In an English kind of version. Slightly less glamorous. And there's a party kind of theme to a lot of the music. And the lure of fame, of course. But they still do this, and they're keeping a message in the music. And it's reality. One of Lethal Bizzle's biggest hits called Pow, is all about gun culture. He's just saying it as it is. And there's an acknowledgement that this exists and it's sort of increasing the problem in the UK. But it's not necessarily cultivating a gangster image, at least not with the police guy. Although, having said this, there are a number of crews who use the music as a way of claiming their sort of gang territory and sending warnings of revenge to other crews. And I found an example of this actually on YouTube from my own estate with the crew called the Piff City Crew, or sometimes the Piff City Paperboys, which doesn't sound very hard to me, but you know, Paperboys represent. And so I found an example of like non-kind of gang-related music from my own estate, but generally speaking, that's not the spirit behind grime. Gang culture exists, and it always has, even when I was a kid as well. And some artists are members of gangs, but the ones that have become successful are the ones that have left the gang mentality behind, and the kids sort of see that. But grime has generated a fair amount of moral panic in the UK. The usual fear of young working class subcultures exaggerated due to the majority of the crews and artists being black. So the stereotype of young black men as violent gang members is perpetuated through the media, and not helped by public figures such as the Tory leader and now Prime Minister of the UK, David Cameron, attacking grime, and specifically the music of Lethal. Cameron stated in an article, I'm quoting from Cameron here, that young and impressionable people are given the message in song after song that guns, knives and other weapons are glamorous. He and many others try to blame the music that depicts and reflects the violence rather than acknowledging, you know, class-based reasons for the increase in violence and, you know, you know the story. In reply, Lethal, he responded in the newspapers, and he said, I'm a young black British music artist and I'm the voice for the streets. You should be working with us instead of laying the blame on us. And he sees what he does as a very positive thing. Lethal assigned a number of young artists to his record label and helped them to stay out of trouble and find some hope. And he suggested to Cameron that he look at ways to get young people involved and engaged. and even offered his services as street MP. He said, like, you know, you're Tories, whatever, I'll go around the streets and I'll screw for you. But Cameron didn't take it. Lethal himself gets involved with local and national youth campaigns, and, you know, I think he's a good role model. That his songs are sometimes about guns reflects the reality of life for young people like him. And Lethal and other artists credit their fans with the intelligence to know that songs about guns are not necessarily condoning, you know, the use of guns. Other artists such as Kano have participated in educational programs aimed at council estate kids, and some have made quite clear anti-violence statements in their songs. And so there's one by Tiny Temper called Put the Guns and Knives Down. It's quite obvious. And a common sentiment is displayed by many of the grime artists that they describe their music as connecting with the young people, and they feel a sense of responsibility. MC Chipmunk says that his heart is in bettering himself and the generation of kids coming up from the streets, and Jamie believes that part of the appeal of grime is that the kids feel ownership of the music. It's something that they can aspire to make themselves rather than just consume this big DIY kind of culture. The music provides a forum for the young people to air their disputes. They can battle with each other via songs, and it can be seen as a way of relieving the tension that builds up on the estate, where young people struggle to find the positive when they're faced with grimy surroundings. That's where it gets its name from, because it's grimy. It really is on this. I mean, you know, look. And an education system that fails them, and the prospect of unemployment. And, you know. Kano states that it's no good to promote violence, but it has to be spoke about. And it can also be seen as a reaction to the constant surveillance that young, particularly black council estate youth are under. Due to police operations such as Operation Trident, which focuses on gun crime in London's black communities, but tends to add to the atmosphere of distrust. Especially the police will shut down grime events because they're paranoid that there are going to be guns at these events. So they have this kind of cycle continuing. So one of the best known grime artists, Wiley, who's up there, who's from the East End of London, and he's often credited with starting the whole sound with his songs Eskimo, what you call it. And he reveals a very positive attitude and claims that he wants people to find themselves through his music. And he always says he'll always remain true to his origins and will never come off the road. So songs such as My Mistakes, which you've got the lyrics there on the sheet, tell the story of his life before he found music and describes how music has empowered him. I'm going to play, I won't play all of these, I'll play you a bit of the song, so just get you to get a little taste of of what it sounds like, that little bit. Hopefully it'll play. Kind of sentiment in his song World Outside, but I'll play it a little bit. I mean, it's kind of more into the song that he talks about his old life and his new life, so you can read through the lyrics after all. But Dizzy is probably the most crossover to the mainstream.
Oh, trip I wanted to share with you. A couple things you're saying and reasons why I can't be there with you. Back in the day, we tried on food but never split trust. Can't see no definite ending to the madness and the just never thought I'd pull back into jacking for something more. Solid, I ain't changed. I just tried to break my way to skim my knowledge running around. Happy to know I can expect me for a while. The studio gave me a lot. My creative soul took me to another world beyond the estate. Some kind of paper from the Jesus from the stress, mate. I want to call it no escape, the blows are in my heart. Making it that was important for me to climb the charts. But it's the sacrifice I made, this all good stuff. Same reason I ain't always in the hood star. I do my thing, you know, I trust it like I always was. It just ain't quite like it was simply cause there's a world that signed up a manner and a word. You can see it, I can see it, I can see it, I can see it. There's a world that signed up an earth and a word. You can see it.
So you get the idea from Mr. Rascal. And it seems to me that words such as those from these like influential and now successful artists, I'm not sure they've crossed over into the United States, but Dizzy Rascal's very popular in Australia. Not that anybody can actually understand what he said. They jump up and down to the music. You know. I've got some issues with that in my kind of elitist rhyme way. But, you know, you don't understand. Not message, you can't just jump up and down. Young people. You know, and there are positive outcomes, I think, for young listeners. To hear someone with their street cred intact articulating about their lives and validating their experiences has to be empowering. And knowing that someone shares and understands the grime and using those examples to find a voice and tell stories that are usually marginalised as a powerful political act. As Kano says, this is music that everyone can get to, but still be the rhythm, and still be the voice of the streets. And it gives disenfranchised youth the community. And as one fan states, it's talking about our life, it's our form of poetry. And this poetry is evident in the linguistic dexterity possessed by the artists. They've got an incredible way with words, and this is working class language inflected with the slang and rhythms of Afro-Caribbean accented English. Young London grime artists in particular developed a rich language of their own that challenges middle-class standard English, and the music challenges mainstream British culture in general. This is a no-holds-barred version of the UK. It's not the London you see in tourist brochures. One of the other songs I won't play, but you've got Dizzy Rascal on there with You Can't Tell Me Nothing, and despite the aggressive tone of the song, his message is really positive. He's saying that posturing as hard, like being a hard man, is pointless, and that being hard isn't an achievement in itself, it's a result of growing up in the ghetto. But it's possible to find a way out of the ghetto mentality through the music. So you can have, you can always look these up. You can buy them on iTunes. So just to provide quickly a bit of gender balance, I'll just throw in Lady Sovereign here. So like Wiley, Kano, and Little Vinny the Rascal, she's had some crossover success, and her music relates to her working class life. There are a number of female grime MCs. So back here, you've got Lady Fury and Ms. Bratz, Lady Fury and Shiesty as well. Sovereign challenges dominant discourse of gender in her music and video clips, and she's an out lesbian as well. And like the other artists, she's a wordsmith, and her song My England demonstrates her attitude towards the way in which British people are supposed to behave. So Sovereign is one of the few white grime artists, and her experiences as a white woman are going to be different to young black men. But she understands life on the estates, and she's, you know, proud of working class culture. She kind of divides people. A lot of people are really annoying. So I'll just play a little bit of her song just to give an idea.
So hopefully this little
short take of UK grunge, giving you an introduction into this vibrant form of working class culture. It's one that's quite culturally specific, I've got to say, but it has the potential to change the lives of some young people who get involved, and shows that working class creativity and also shows that marginalised people always find ways to express themselves and get their stories out there in their own communities. And now that this music is beginning to enter the mainstream, it will be interesting to see what the wider effects will be, like whether it will lose its edge and just become really commercialised, or if it will help reach an even larger group of young people who need something to ignite their revolutionary experience. So, yeah. Thank you. Because I'm dealing with a text that deals with the experiences of a transgendered individual and respecting Leslie Feinberg, the author's preference for gender-neutral pronouns, I'm going to be using he for he, she, and here for him, her. So just bear with me, because it can get a little when you're reading. It's hard to maintain sometimes, but, okay? So that's why you're not saying, what is she saying, herself? But it's, you know. So I'm going to be using that with respect to Feinberg and with respect to the transgendered protagonist of this novel, Jess. In an article published in Workers' World, a socialist newspaper, Leslie Feinberg identified as a, quote, secular Jewish communist, a working class lesbian, transgender Marxist, end quote. What is not only clear, but also clearly important to Feinberg, that class matters, both in the ways he sees herself and his struggle for social change, remains unclear to many critics of her work, with these critics instead privileging gender and sexuality as significant for understanding writing such as Stonebridge Blues, a novel that centers on the experiences of a transgendered, same-sex-oriented trade unionist as she wrote and sees it. Z grows up in a blue-collar Buffalo of the 1950s, comes out in the bars and factories of the 1960s, and passes for a man when Z is left without a community in the 1970s. This project reads working class back into critical representations of identity and experience in Stonebridge Blues, focusing specifically on the intersections formed in the novel between transgender and working class. I argue in this project that Feinberg's protagonist moves through distinctly working class spaces, the bar, the factory, and the tenement apartments in Buffalo and later New York City, wherein each space produces in Jess a consciousness of being differently gendered and working class. Unlike other critics of Stonebridge Blues, then, I understand Jess's journey in the novel to resemble not the playful performance of a transgender, as in Queer Theory, or that of a transsexual in search of home in the sex body, as is the case for Jay Prosser, but his movement for Jess within and among class spaces. Hence, this project also explores a politics of representation within such spaces. Critics such as Kat Moses have usefully examined the bar of Stonebridge Blues as a working class specific site in which Feinberg's protagonist is subject to frequent police raids and the gender policing that occurs with regularity in the novel. In other words, the working class bar acts as a site where working class and different gender overlap in significant ways, among them how Jess's being of the working class makes her gender expression doubly dangerous. It is curious, given critics' interest in the representation of space in Stonebridge Blues, that the factory remained absent from any such discussion, particularly since it's a working class site, it shares with the bar this paradox of space in the novel as both painful and pleasing to Jess. The factory of Stonebridge Blues, then, provides for Jess the threat of industrial violence and the communitas formed among butches and those sympathetic to butch issues. Importantly, the factory also offers Jess a platform from which to demand butch respectability outside the bars. My interest in the factory of Stonebridge Blues is twofold. First, it is in this space that Feinberg attempts to resolve what Moses finds limited about class unity in the novel, namely how Jess's lack of effort to understand the Duboisian of double consciousness of Black Butch feels is an obstacle to class unity. In this way, I read Feinberg's use of the factory as a site for class unity, apparent by frequent strikes and solidarity among workers across dividing lines, as consistent with here liberation politics, or how by the novel's close, Jess has adopted union organizing as an effective model for other kinds of liberation. Second, as a site of class conflict, the factory provides for Feinberg the events necessary to place blame where it belongs in your novel, on capitalism's method of divide and conquer, and not on workers themselves. This is why, then, those who stand against butches, the foreman, a worker set on advancement at the expense of others,
are also those who stand on the side of capitalists. The sections in which the factory figure prominently in Stonebush Blues are largely organized around Jess's movement in the novel from working in the bush to passing as a man for safety and employment. In the first of these sections, and with the exception of the first bindery where he works, Jess's battles are largely the result of here gender expression, as a quote-unquote he-she, the foreman frequently pits Jess against other workers, with his baiting culminating in a quote-unquote work accident that leaves Feinberg's protagonist disfigured. When Jess passes for a man, the nature of these battles changes from one of gender to a psychological war in which Jess is the only combatant. In this project, I suggest that Jess's passing for a man leaves here homeless, an exile from both here biological sex and from the communities he found in the bars and in the factories. In part, what Jess longs for in here 20-year exile is that which is pleasing about the working class space of the factory, the communitas formed among butches and those sympathetic with butch issues. At the second bindery where Jess works, a job he secures due to the disproportionate number of young working class men fighting in Vietnam, Feinberg's protagonist locates this communitas with nine other butches, quote, nine of us, it was heaven, end quote. Here in the space of the bindery, Jess informally serves as union leader for fellow butches. In a quote unquote unprecedented reversal of roles, older butches come to Jess for help with problems on the shop floor or with the union. Jess may find only enjoyment in this role reversal, but Feinberg posits it as the start of here protagonist union organizing in the novel. For Jess, it is not until Z is promoted over a black male worker that Z begins to realize how capitalism and institutionalized racism, like that of homophobia and sexism, both function to divide workers. In this way, Jess comes to see her own struggle as interrelated to not only Leroy's battle with institutionalized racism, but I would argue to a larger history of working class struggle. In other words, Jess locates herself among a collective, the point Z reinforces when Z implores Grant and other butches to, quote, make the guys see that they need us too, end quote. Without butches, men at the plant lack the strength and numbers necessary to win on the picket line. Without the support of these men, butches are left to negotiate with the foreman on their own, which is rarely, if ever, effective. Is that the moment in which Jess rallies other butches to the cause of the union, which is to say that Jess also rallies butches to the cause of other workers, many of whom are heterosexual white men? Because, you know, there's the working class white, and then there's butches and all these other people are on the opposing sides, supposedly. The Feinberg's protagonist makes here transition from informal union leader to union organizer. What follows in the first of these sections, then, is how Jess organizes other butches as he also informs co-workers of butch issues. I am most interested in the latter of these, particularly since Feinberg uses alliances between peer protagonists and other workers as textual evidence for a class unity that exists between a mainstream working class and transgender butches like Jess. In the bindery of Stonebush Blues, Jess as union organizer is uniquely positioned in what becomes in the novel another overlap of working class with other areas of experience. To put this differently, Jess as being of the working class provides her with a platform from which to demand butch respectability in working class spaces outside the bars. The factory becomes in a space where, as Feinberg suggests in an article of Workers' World, quote, sex and gender issues are increasingly discussed and thought on the shop floor. When Jess is promoted over Leroy to grade 5, he learns from Duffy, the heterosexual man who fosters for organizing, that the foreman Jack would rather promote a he-she than work with a black man. In response, Jess sides with Duffy in the union as he refuses promotion and instead supports Leroy's advancement. Earlier, I argued that in Stonebush Blues, the foreman frequently stands against butches. At the bindery, Jack uses Jess to create divisions among butches and non-white workers. Yet Jess's refusal of promotion works to undo this division, as it garners Jess respect from other men in the factory who also appropriately identify Jack as the enemy. Feinberg emphasizes his solidarity when, after the incident, men at the plant recognize Jess for siding with workers. Quote, Sammy, the truck driver, patted my shoulder, end quote, while, quote, Walter, the repairman, caught my eye and nodded his head once in my direction, end quote. Importantly, Jess uses this moment to downplay differences among workers in favor of what they have in common, namely their distrust of Jack. This decision on Jess's part is largely consistent with Feinberg's own experiences in the factories of Buffalo. Feinberg writes in Transgender Warriors that when the foreman tried to pit workers against here, Z would remind them that he cared little for their misery. Jess provides a similar function in Stonebush Blues. He demonstrates for other workers how butch and working class need not be mutually exclusive terms. While at work in the bindery that began this section, Jess details the foreman's many attempts to sabotage worker solidarity. Largely, this sabotage involved pitting workers against one another along lines of race, gender, ethnicity, or sexuality. At the second bindery, however, sabotage results not in insults or jokes about Jess, but rather industrial violence. Jack, angrier with the solidarity that results from Jess's refusal of promotion, coerces Jess's coworker to remove a safety pin on a machine on which she will instruct Feinberg's protagonist to work. Jess narrates not only the pain that follows, but also the support Z receives from her coworkers. Quote, it happened so fast. One moment my fingers were all connected to me. The next moment I could feel my ring finger lying against my palm. My blood spurted in an arc across the machine, the deck of cards stacked on skids, and the wall in front of me. The next thing I remember was being in a car. Walter had his arm around me. Duffy was driving, and he kept turning around for a sign from Walter. Walter lifted my injured hand up high with one of his large, gentle hands and held me tightly against him with the other. I shook violently. It's going to be okay, honey, he crooned. I've seen a lot of these things happen. It's going to be all right. What is significant about this scene is twofold. First, it further illustrates the paradox Feinberg employs in her descriptions of working class spaces such as the factory. Second, it attends to what Janet Zandi calls the, quote, physicality of work, end quote, that figures prominently in working class writing. In other words, Jess's work accident reflects a larger history of writing in which, as Zandi insists, quote, injuries and deaths accumulate, end quote. Consistent with this paradox in Stovich Blues, Jess's experience with industrial violence is at once painful and pleasing. Pleasing because of the support he receives from her coworkers. Jess says, after Duffy demands an investigation of the accident, quote, I marveled at the idea that a straight person would stand up for me, or for any she, end quote. Cat Moses may read Stonewich Blues as a narrative in which Jess can only yearn for class unity, but the details of these factory scenes suggest otherwise. Here, and precipitated by a shared experience with violence, Jess finds communitas among butches, as well as among men like Walter and Duffy, the latter of whom repeatedly side with Jess against foremen such as Jack. In what is perhaps the clearest indication of class solidarity in Feinberg's novel, Jeff and her co-workers strike when the contract expires at the bindery. Earlier, I suggested that one of the ways working class intersects with other identity categories in Stovich Blues is in the formation of a gender-variant community based on largely shared class interests. The picket line in this scene, factory scene, produces one such example, though I would argue it also serves as a site in which the experiences of butches and a more mainstream working class significantly overlap. And I want to make a note here about mainstream. This is set in the 60s, 70s, so before this sort of kind of real major shift happens in the 1980s, where the workforce is obviously changing, the nature of the work is changing, low-wage work is working class labor and superior with manufacturing, and this is, of course, manufacturing. So most of the people who are working here are white working class men and women. The first of these instances occurs when Jess's male coworkers use the epithet faggot to emasculate scabs, a rhetorical move that causes Jess and other butches to recoil. Although Feinberg could have stopped here, which is to say that Z could have used this moment to distance Jess from other men at the, factory, Z instead reinforces the community among workers in the plant when Walter proclaims, quote, ah, shit, we didn't mean you guys. Until this moment, Walter has not yet realized the pain associated with the terms such as faggot, even for butches like Jess. Feinberg is quick to emphasize here how butch gender expression or same-sex orientation increases the threat of violence for working-class persons when, in the second of these instances of overlap, butch Jan is threatened to a police van with three other strikers. Jess implores Duffy, quote, think about it, it's different for her to get busted, end quote. As but only one of two times in Stonebridge Blues, Jess allows someone other than a butcher femme to read on her face the shame that results from repeated beatings and rapes. He narrates that when Duffy reads this shame, he nodded, quote, he understood, end quote. In what follows, 100 workers unite to free Jan and the other strikers, going so far as to rock the police. People from the projects form a protective circle around the workers. I want to argue that this scene ultimately resolves what Moses finds problematic about class unity in Stonebridge Blues, particularly in the way workers, despite their many differences, stand against a common enemy, company bosses, and later the police. The specter of the police in Feinberg's novel resurfaces in these factory scenes, though not to police gender. This kind of policing happens in closed spaces, such as the working class bar and the police interrogation room, as Moses makes clear in her article. Jess remarks after the strike that, quote, the police really stepped up their harassment after the birth of gay pride, end quote. Implied by Jess's comment is the way working class butchers and femmes were not, quote unquote, liberated by the gay pride movement. Unlike middle and upper class gays and lesbians, they were not engaged in a battle against heteronormativity or the religious right, but were rather fighting for their lives in the face of police brutality. In this way, the birth of gay pride intensified violence against working class, transgendered, and same-sex oriented persons, a point Jess reinforces when Z decides to take male hormones and begins passing as a man. For critics such as Jay Prosser, Jess's decision to pass is best understood through a transsexual narrative. one in which Jess transitions to feel more quote-unquote at home and hear Sex body. I've argued elsewhere that such a reading fails to account for how Jess continues to identify as female, even after Z passes as a man. It's important to emphasize here that Jess does not desire to change her biological sex. For here, hormones and chest reconstruction surgery were ways to bring out what seemed masculine in herself, a matter of gender expression or presentation and not sex. Yet hormones and surgery were also ways to stay alive in the face of unemployment and police violence. In other words, unlike Prosser, who maintains that, quote, Jess is depersonalization of transsexuality, for she represents transitioning as simply a politically meaningful act, the only thing for a stone butch to do at this particular cultural moment, is radically contradicted by her transsexual desire, that feeling of displacement from the sex body and the yearning to resolve it, the desire for home, end quote. I would suggest that in Stonebridge Blues, Jess decides to pass for a man not because Z feels displaced from Kier's sex body, but because Z realizes that Z won't stay alive otherwise. Read in this way, I refuse to call Jess's journey a transition, the latter of which implies movement from one sex, female, to its opposite, male. Rather, I understand this journey as a pathing that is, contrary to Prosser's claim, circumstantially motivated. To put this differently, I read Jess's passing as exclusively matters of unemployment and the harassment to which Jess refers after the birth of Gay Pride. By 1973, the number of U.S. troops in Vietnam drastically declined. In the same year, with young working class men resuming work in the factories, Jess and other butches find themselves laid off and out of work. What follows is Jess's conversation with Grant and Edwin about how to survive now that hard labor in the factories has been labeled a man's job. Feinberg makes very clear throughout this conversation that choosing to take male hormones results not from feeling differently sexed, what Grant means when she says, quote, I'm not a guy, end quote, but from a real need to pay the rent and to be safe from police violence. Unlike Jimmy, the only female-to-male transsexual in the novel, Jess intends for hormone use for passing, not a transition, a point he emphasizes when he asks Grant and Edwin, quote, what happens? Does it just last for a little while? I mean, can you go back to being a butch later when it's safe to come out, end quote? I labor on this distinction between passing and transition because I believe Prosser's insistence on the latter obscures the very real conditions that precipitate Jess's decision. Furthermore, locating this decision with embodiment, and embodiment alone, and not simply embodiment and unemployment and police brutality, ignores the class dimensions of the novel or how class constraints are consistently at work on Feinberg's protagonist. Hormones and surgery may open a window for Jess, but they do not provide for here access to less dangerous and better paying work, luxuries often afforded to those with college degrees. In Stonebridge Blues, Jess finds employment while passing as a man in the factories, in part because of her skill as a laborer, but also in an effort to reclaim the communitas lost with Teresa, her former lover's leaving, and Grant's alienation. Grant, her butch friend, leaves her because Grant doesn't want to take the hormones. The difference, however, between working as a butch and passing as a man in the factories is how with the latter Jess becomes the invisible man, when it was seen but not seen, a man without a past. Jess may find community in the factories, but passing restricts how close Jess may become with another worker, made evident with Jess's eventual estrangement from Ben, a heterosexual young man, and your feelings of isolation from femmes while at work. Jess cannot make your desire known if Z is taken for a man. Despite the problems posed by passing, I argue in this project that Jess forges alliances with coworkers for the same reasons he did while working as a butch, because the circumstances of plant life demand such alliances. In particular, this project is interested in two events from the second of factory scenes, the strike that immediately follows Jess's passing and Jess's return to union organizing. Prior to securing work again at a binary, Jess resorts to temp labor. One of these jobs leads Jess and her coworkers to a plant outside of Buffalo where workers have gone on strike. Quote, as we approach the plant, end quote, Jess narrates, quote, I understood. We were hired to break a strike. Scabs. The shout went up the moment we got off the bus. It was hard to catch my breath in the frigid air, end quote. Despite their apparent need for work, Jess and others like Ben refused to cross the picket line. In this moment, Feinberg has your protagonist stand once again on the side of workers. Ben, along with 60 other men, makes the same decision, with the oldest man among the 60 proclaiming, quote, the devil can't buy my soul, end quote. In what follows, these workers unite with the strikers, although many are near destitute or have families to support. Quote, I'm no scab, Ben shouted. I've never crossed a picket line in my life, and I never will. And I've got no respect for any man who does. He took his UAW card out of his wallet and held it aloft so the picketers could see. Several of the other men pulled out their union cards and held them proudly too. I, Jess, clenched my fist and pumped the air. The strikers cheered us, end quote. Not only does Jess refuse to sign with company bosses to secure her own advancement, but she also sees herself as a part of this collective struggle, much in the same way he did during the first strike in which Z participated. Jeff can hide as a man, but Z cannot hide here allegiance to the working class. Even with her fear of being unmasked as female, Jeff agrees to serve on a union organizing committee at the third bindery where Z works, after a co-worker's lung is pierced in a quote-unquote work accident. In her description of the accident and the unsafe work conditions that caused it, Feinberg emphasizes the class-specific circumstances that necessitate class unity, as well as your protagonist's call to union organizing, the latter of which Jeff turns to as an effective model for liberation when Z journeys to New York City at the novel's close. Shortly after the strike outside of Buffalo, Jess decides to stop hormone treatment. For Prosser, this decision coincides with a narrative shift in Stonebridge Blues from transsexuality to transgendered embodiment, wherein, quote, Jess's inner transgender identity is determining her sense of herself, not her performance, sexual and social, as a man, end quote. Unlike Prosser, I would argue that at no point prior to, during, or after her passing does Jess identify as anything other than a he/she. In other words, I do not read Jess's decision to stop hormones at the moment at which Z begins to see herself as transgendered. Rather, throughout Stonebridge Blues, Jess identifies as differently gendered. Z is not a quote-unquote Saturday night butch, someone who's only butch on Saturday, but not all the time, and only stops hormones because Z can no longer see the complexities of her gender. It may not yet be safe for her as a transgendered butch, but Jess can no longer be the exile, both from her biological sex and from the working class communities he found in the bars and in the factories. Z realizes, despite her want, that Buffalo might never provide for her a permanent home. And so, in an attempt to end her lonely exile, Jess continues on her journey to New York City, a place where she hopes to find, quote, jobs and others like her, end quote.
Primary elements of working class culture and identities. We use the qualities of and requirements for a job as well as its status in defining who is working class. And when we talk about the nature of working class culture, we often talk about how work shapes people's lives and worldviews, their attitudes about work, and the social and economic power they have depending on a job. In working class literary studies, work has been a prominent theme, both as one of the defining qualities of working class literature and as a central theme in literary texts and literary analysis. Janet Vandy argues that working class texts highlight the lived material experience of working class people. She develops this idea by focusing on how working class texts reveal the physicality of work. You see the thinking body at work, both productive and reproductive labor, and the effects of work on the human body. Her Steady Hands explores this theme in a variety of forms and genres. Similarly, Laura Hapke has taken representations of labor as the focus of her work on both literature and art. Paul Lauder notes that powerful descriptions of physical labor are fixtures of working class texts because they embody experiences of particular kinds of work, because they convey the qualities of that experience to an audience mainly unfamiliar with it, and because they establish the context in which other events accrue meaning. Neither literary critics nor scholars of work has suggested that work alone defines working class culture, but its centrality as a theme in working class life and literature is clear. At the same time, working class studies has sometimes been accused of focusing too much on what we might term the traditional working class, that is, the industrial blue-collar working class. This focus is problematic both because such workers have never been the whole of the working class, and because economic and social changes over the last three decades have led to significant declines in industrial work. The working class has not disappeared because of this, but the nature of their work and their lives has changed in important ways. Many scholars, myself included, have studied the shift, often focusing on how the loss of work affects people and their communities. No doubt, the story of deindustrialization is an important part of working class studies. And yet, as a 30-something friend pointed out to me a couple of years ago, the experience of deindustrialization has changed over time and is different for people of different generations. John was born in 1977, the year of the first major steel mill closing in Youngstown, and so he grew up in a period of intense economic struggle and uncertainty. It's clear that he was strongly affected by the experience. He's now a leader in a local movement of young professionals working to revitalize the city, in part by celebrating its history. Youngstown now, he told me, is the best it's ever been in his lifetime. So while older people are full of nostalgia for the fabulous Youngstown of the past, For him, the past has a different, more complex meaning. John's story reminds us that the experiences of the children of deindustrialization and the continuing lives of their communities may be deeply rooted in traditional working class past, but they are also distinctly different, and their relationship with that past is conflicted and complicated. In Youngstown, as in much of the Rust Belt, a generation of working class people have grown up without the experience of industrial labor. They haven't experienced the dangers or physical exertion of making steel or mining coal, and in many cases, they didn't even watch their parents come home from such jobs. Nor have they felt the sense that such workers often describe of being part of a large and important collective effort. They know neither the hardships nor the romance of industrial work, except as the subject of stories about the past. They have done, and many continue to do, working class jobs, but their jobs exact a different kind of collateral damage, an injury that is perhaps more psychological than physical. They work as retail clerks and bartenders, nursing home aides, and call center staffers. Similarly, while they often recognize that the history of their hometown matters, many resist defining their own lives and their communities entirely in terms of the past. The perspective of children of deindustrialization is being expressed in a variety of forms, including fiction. Younger Rust Belt writers are telling stories about the long-term effects of economic change and the social and psychological legacies of the decline of the industrial working class. They are creating a new body of literature, some of it distinctly working class, some less clearly so. How does this new writing about deindustrialized communities and the children of displaced workers both continue and change patterns of working class literature? Before we can answer that question, we have to survey the landscape. What does deindustrialization literature look like? And I want to spend some time describing to you the books that I'm looking at, just because most of them will be unfamiliar, I think, to most of you. But I want to say at this point that if you know of books that might fit into this category, please let me know. I am building this study by talking to people. And they say, oh, I know another book you should read. So if you know a book I should read, let me know. I began thinking about how deindustrialization is represented in fiction because of three novels by Tawny O'Dell. She has since written one more. All are set in declining mining towns in her home region of western Pennsylvania. They share a focus on the adult, though often just barely adult, children of coal miners. O'Dell's stories pair community-wide patterns of job loss and industrial decline with dramatic family problems, incest, child abuse, alcoholism, infidelity, a combination that might explain how her first novel, Backroads, became an Oprah's Book Club selection. While her work may sometimes seem overly dramatic, perhaps a bit too interested in reaching popular audiences by focusing on the dysfunctions that she sees in working-class families, she nonetheless provides a useful starting place for understanding how deindustrialization affects those who are not directly displaced, and she makes clear how industrial work and its loss shapes not just individuals, but whole communities. Another book in the genre, American Rust by Philip Meyer, attracted considerable attention nationally. It came out a little over a year ago, and critics in the New York Times and other mainstream publications praised it lavishly. I was not taken by it, though it's an interesting and useful contribution to the genre. The book examines the lives of two young men, both the children of displaced steelworkers, struggling to find their places as adults in a community that no longer offers much economic opportunity. I'm not entirely comfortable with the book's representation of working class cultures. Characters have immediate family ties, but none of the extended family bonds that often ensure survival in such communities. A character who leaves to attend Yale on a scholarship seems to feel only mild guilt about having left her family behind and encounters no cognitive dissonance as she enters an upper-class world. See why I might be skeptical. Meyer does a good job, however, as do most of these books, of capturing the landscape of deindustrialization as well as making visible the lack of direction, self-doubt, and internal conflicts that many children of deindustrialization feel. The two protagonists of the book want to leave their hometown, but both also feel the strong pull of family ties and the security of the familiar. While my next example focuses less clearly on deindustrialization or community, it offers an intriguing look at how displaced workers and their communities are perceived by those who grew up during deindustrialization. Christopher Barzak is an award-winning author of contemporary fantasy literature, whose first novel, One for Sorrow, is set in a small town northwest of Youngstown, the sort of town you'd find if you drove the back road from Youngstown up to Cleveland, and in fact the sort of town where Barzac grew up before he came to Youngstown State University. For the novel's narrator, as for Barzac, Youngstown was not home, but was always present, important and a little frightening. A long section of the book takes place in Youngstown, and the city's decaying landscape plays a major role. The narrator, a high school student who has, without actually dying, become a ghost, don't ask me to explain it, describes how the ghosts of long-dead mill workers are still present in the city. A whistle shrieked once, twice, a third time, and the dead lifted their heads in its direction. A moment later, they poured from the abandoned factories, and others materialized to take their places and begin their shift. The mill had closed years and years ago, but the dead still came here, even though it was clear that what they wanted didn't want them. That theme of displacement runs through the novel, as it does through most deindustrialization literature, and Barzac shows how the feelings associated with deindustrialization can affect even those who did not experience it directly and continue to shape a community long after the actual closings. Barzac pointed me towards another example, Dean Bukopoulos' novel and stories, Please Don't Come Back to the Movie, which also has some fantasy elements. Set in the suburbs of Detroit, beginning in the late 1980s, the novel traces the early adulthood of a young man whose father, like all the fathers in their working class neighborhood, has disappeared. Everyone says that they went to the moon. Their disappearance can be read as a metaphor for the economic and emotional losses of deindustrialization, which displaced so many working class men during the 70s and 80s. But instead of focusing on the immediate aftermath of plant closings, this book follows what happens to the son, Michael, the novel's narrator. We watch as he considers applying to the University of Michigan, where his high school girlfriend goes, but instead enrolls part-time first at a community college and later at the more accessible U of M Dearborn, where he studies English and creative writing. We follow him through a series of jobs, from being a lifeguard to working in a mall bookstore to finally landing a position at a local radio news station. We see him slouching towards family life, ultimately marrying a co-worker from the bookstore, adopting her young son, and having another child. And we see him continually haunted by the absence of his father. At the same time, Michael's story illustrates the uncertainty many children of deindustrialization feel about how to mold their lives. With their father's options foreclosed and limited opportunities for either education or fulfilling employment, Michael and his friends have little sense of direction or purpose. Near the end of the novel, they seem about to follow their fathers to the moon, though without the impetus of job loss. Instead of being displaced from jobs, they feel displaced from their lives. On the other hand, demonstrated in a story in which one of the sons begins and ultimately abandons an effort to organize retail workers at a mall to hold a Black Friday sit-down strike inspired by the 1937 Flint strike. And I have to say, I love this story and I love that idea. They understand very well that their working lives are more episodic and less satisfying than their father's, and that they lack the previous generation's sense of solidarity and activism. In the lost tiki palaces of Detroit, Michigan writer Michael Zadorian locates his stories in different parts of the city. The book has three sections, East Side, West Side, and Downtown. While few of his characters are overtly working class, they are clearly rooted in Detroit and its history of economic struggle and racial tension, and they do not fit the standard middle-class model of success. They include younger adults struggling to find their place, a junk store owner feeling vulnerable, a salesman who begins to really notice the city and people around him after his car is shot at on the freeway, a euthanasia tech at a pet shelter, and the only white guy riding a bus down Woodward Avenue on his way to an unnamed job. For all of them, both Detroit as a place and the last few decades as a time have defined their positions and perspectives. Perhaps the best example is Spelunkers, a story about a freelance copy editor who runs a website called The Paris of the Midwest is Crumbling, featuring photographs of the inside of abandoned but significant Detroit buildings, along with comments about their history. The site is, as he describes it, uber-urban, ex-industrial, proto-apocalyptic, Rust Belt cool, or whatever the underground magazines who worship Detroit are calling us these days. As this sentence suggests, the narrator operates on the edge between real appreciation of the past, ironic engagement with it because it's cool, and disdain for the very idea that the past has become cool. As he tours the old buildings, he thinks about the people who used them, a As he says in an old movie theater, it's so strange to think about the thousands of people, the millions, who walked through here over the years, seeing Dr. Zhivago or I Am Curious Yellow or Shaft's Big Score or whatever, just standing here. You can tell that people laughed and cried and applauded here, smiled at each other. They threw popcorn and drank Pepsi and broke their teeth on GGBs. He goes on, offering a comment on the building that might apply to the very city itself and we might extrapolate to the people of the city. It's awful that this would even happen to a building. This should never happen anywhere. But I see something like this and I want to try to find the beauty in it, make some sense of it, give it a reason, fill it with something. This ambivalence about the industrial past is a theme throughout the collection. And like the narrator of Spelunkers, Zadurian himself balances on the fine line between cynicism and romanticism. That urge to make what has been lost or abandoned into something beautiful shapes much of deindustrialization literature. These writers attempt to capture the effects of growing up amidst loss and struggle, themes that run through much of working class literature. But their characters' lives are complicated by a broader sense of widespread economic and sociological change. In every one of these books, characters sense that the world has no place for them. The forms of work and community that shaped their parents' lives are no longer available, nor do the emerging options offer much in the way of meeting our opportunity. Even those like Michael, and Please Don't Come Back from the Moon, who find their way into the lower rungs of the middle class, don't feel comfortable there. Displacement has become a state of mind, not just an economic condition. One element of that internalized displacement is the ambiguous class position of some of the characters. While most are clearly working class, the children of displaced miners, steel workers, and auto workers, many are also pursuing or have completed college, and so they represent what Al Lubrano calls straddlers. But most are straddlers whose footing is weighted heavily on the working class side, while others, especially in Michael Zadurian's stories, represent the insecure wing of the creative class. Most exemplify the notion that people who come from working class backgrounds do not entirely lose the culture of their home class when they acquire education or a more middle class job. Others suggest the existence of what we might call deindustrialization culture, a set of values and perspectives rooted in the working class industrial history of places and that shares with working class culture an appreciation for hard work, grit, toughness, and survival. At the same time, deindustrialization literature is often conflicted about the past. The past is always present in these stories, shaping the landscape, individual psyches and relationships, and the quality of community life. And while industrial work is often viewed with some nostalgia, its dangers and difficulties are often invisible. Characters have been injured physically and psychologically by work and its loss. In American Rust, for example, the parent of one of the protagonists, a former steelworker, has been paralyzed on the job, while the mother of another has internalized the idea that she isn't worthy of a job better than the one she has as a seamstress, one that is also causing her physical injury. The two sons have also been shaped by their parents' experiences with and the loss of work, and both resist pursuing opportunities for college scholarships out of a combination of self-doubt and guilt. In part because these novels and stories are about the loss of industrial work, work itself often takes a back seat. In Zadurian stories, for example, we see how people are affected by their jobs, as in the despair and guilt felt by a young woman who euthanizes abandoned animals as a shelter. But more often, work exists outside the frame of the story. The young man is on the bus riding to work, but what he does is never mentioned. And the point of the story is what he sees on the ride, not the destination. In the best of O'Dell's novels, Coal Run, the work that dominates the story, coal mining, is almost entirely gone. And for most of the characters, the foundational experience of their lives is a major mine disaster that killed dozens of men in 1967, 20 years before the story takes place. In those novels where we do see people at work, the writers often clearly contrast new forms of working class work with older forms. The most common form of work represented in these stories is retail. Bacopoulos provides a poignant and very concrete comparison between the nature of retail work and the jobs done by previous generations. Our grandfathers used to work the afternoon shift at Ford Rouge or Dodge Main, carrying busted up metal lunch pails. At 6 o'clock, they sat down to dinner far from their kitchens, eating cold cabbage rolls and city chicken, drinking lukewarm coffee from their thermoses. Our fathers walked into factories and warehouses and fluorescent lit buildings every morning, brown bags stuffed with Fritos and bologna sandwiches and an apple or a banana. We ate our lunches and dinners every day at Maple Rock Mall Food Court, chili dogs and cheddar beef sandwiches and Taco El Grande, with the buzz of shoppers and elevator music around us. As this passage suggests, work and working class culture are clearly present and significant in deindustrialization literature, but these books offer powerful, often moving representations of how economic and social changes are redefining what it means for people and places to be working class. A few years ago, I had an odd conversation with a woman I just met at a party. When I told her that part of my job is running the Center for Working Class Studies, she looked at me with some surprise and asked, "Is there still a working class in this country?" I was stunned at that question. But as I work with these novels, I think one way of understanding them is to see them as asking a variation of that question. What happens to the working class, and what happens to their children when the work that defines them disappears?
Give a conditional apology. I have to skedaddle shortly after this panel, so if I have to miss a conversation, I'm not. This is what I really got to get to hear.
It's a working class thing. Your parents matter.
The new title for the papers. I might as well stay on this plantation and let me take shit like that. Because I don't know if I'll get to that quote in this paper.
Say that again. It was a phone call.
I might as well stay on the plantation. I'm going to take shit like that. I think it's a good radicalizing motto for the middle class. I don't know if people know Milton Margiano. Most people I encountered don't. He's a really intriguing, fascinating kind of author to me, and I wish I could give you a lot more background on him, but I really kind of want to get into his work and set a context for it. So, otherwise, Milton Margiano. I think it's in the title. He's a Hawaiian author. In his early novels, he had trouble, thin and wiry, fabulous novel, all asking for somebody. He had a lot of trouble getting it published because he wrote in pidgin. His characters speak pidgin. And he said, you can't write again. This is not English. There was a lot of difficulty just in terms of cultural differences. I want to start just by setting some historical and political context for his novels about Hawaii. In his study, Overthrow, America's Century of Regime Change from Hawaii to Iraq, Stephen Kinzer charts the history of U.S. imperialist behavior, arguing that the invasion of Iraq in 2003 is not an isolated episode, but rather the culmination of a 110-year period during which Americans overthrew 14 governments that displeased them for various ideological, political, and economic reasons. He identifies the annexation of Hawaii as a pivotal and inaugurating moment, initiating an era in which the United States has assumed the right to intervene anywhere in the world, typically with a motive to establish, promote, and defend the right of Americans to do business anywhere around the world without interference, although obviously these are the justifications, blah, 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 democracy, blah, blah, blah. While Kinzer identifies the annexation of Hawaii as initiating a U.S. foreign policy characterized by global intervention, he does suggest that Hawaii's fate was relatively more benign than that other nations have experienced. Hanani K. Trask, a major voice in the Hawaiian sovereignty movement, in her work, From a Native Daughter, Colonialism and Sovereignty in Hawaii, however, asserts no matter what Americans believe, most of us in the colonies do not feel grateful that our country was stolen, along with our citizenship, our lands, and our independent place among the family of nations. We are not happy natives. These differing portrayals notwithstanding, Trask's works indicates another, perhaps even complementary perspective from which to elaborate the historical narrative of Kinzer tells. Indeed, if the case of Hawaii stands as a revealing starting point for studying initiation and evolution of U.S. imperialist aggression as a centerpiece, even defining habit of foreign policy, we might extrapolate from Kinzer's narrative that the U.S. colonization of Hawaii stands as a key moment of class formation within the perhaps more extensive process of colonialism in U.S. working class history, which is why Moriyama's novels interest me to some extent. The process of colonizing Hawaii in conjunction with the process of class formation involved in that process provides a fertile context in which to explore a major contradiction in forming U.S. society, as it is a colonizing moment in which we see the full arsenal of the American ideology of egalitarianism, democracy, and freedom deployed in the very acts of depriving people of self-determination, of creating inequality, and enforcing relationships of domination and subordination in the name of spreading freedom and democracy. and exploring this context in literary terms, like specifically working class literary terms. I want to look at Moriyama, who participates in the making of American literature, as his work literally chronicles the colonization of Hawaii and the making of America, right? He charts us through statehood. His tetralogy, which includes All I Ask Him For Is My Body in 1975, 5 Years on a Rock in 1995, Plantation Boy in 1998, and Dying in a Strange Land in 2008, which I just started. I just got it. Followed the Moriyama family from its immigration to Hawaii from Japan, to the labor strikes on the plantations involving Japanese and Filipino workers in 1920 and 1937 and 1946, to the inclusion of Hawaii as a state in 1959. I want to explore how his novels All I Ask Him For Is My Body and Plantation Boy, I want to look at how they represent the process of the formation of a specifically Asian American working class and working class consciousness as Japanese and Filipino workers negotiate class solidarity on the plantations, and as the Oyamas and their children negotiate their identification with Japan, particularly in the context of World War II. And what we see in his novels, where we see these Filipino workers and Japanese workers, is the making of an Asian American identity, right, in a specific U.S. context. We see how that identity comes to be, really prefiguring the Third World movements of the 1960s in the U.S. More specifically, you know, there's another component. It is, I have a colleague at my university studying Puerto Ricans in Hawaii, in Puerto Rican literature in Hawaii. And one line in the Moriyama novel somewhere, he mentions a Puerto Rican character. So there's another fascinating component that I have yet to fully explore. So just so you know, if you're interested. It's a really fascinating place. But more specifically, I want to look at how Moriyama's novels represent the Asian American working class experience in Hawaii as one of internal colonization, according to which the workers are colonized as oppressed racial groups, indeed as nations, and also as exploited workers. The novels critique ideologies of possessive individualism and self-reliance, and implicitly underwrite militant resistance to racism and imperialism that are founded familiarly on in a Pan-Asian American working class, Pan-Asian American working class national consciousness. Just as a brief theoretical context, it seems to me that when we talk about globalization today, when we talk about cosmopolitanism and post-colonial theory, there's a real attack on the very subject of the nation as a form of political resistance. And I would suggest that you can see this in many Black international politics, which I'll discuss with you below. And to me, this is the maintenance of an old world order of already existing nation states, right? It's those who already inhabit nation states, right? Who say, don't be a nation,
yeah.
Right? Live with us. And at the same time, this entails as a colonizing strategy the denationalization of other peoples who instead are refigured as racial or ethnic minorities, right? Instead of as nations. And Solomon Wong has two definitive article on this that appeared in the early 90s in Appalachian Journal called Denationalization Reconsidered. This project of denationalization is not new. Look back over time, you see Harry Haywood in his political autobiography, The Communist Party of the USA, Black Bolshevik, right, engages in long discussions on the left where he fought for projects of self-determination, so we need to be understood as nations, and so you know, just racial minorities that are part of the working class, fight with the working class without fully understanding the specific interests of that people. Right? Black and white unite and fight tends to come about when white workers decide to need a little help. And the impulse behind Malcolm X's call for Black nationalism was to elevate the struggle from civil rights to human rights, and from the U.S. national stage to the international arena. Right, it gives them a voice, it gives them a place in the West, which is what Kras was talking about. Right, we've lost our independent place among nations. Vine Deloria and Clifford Lytle, in their 1984 study, "The Nations Within: The Past, Present, and Future of American Indian Sovereignty," chart the American Indian struggle to resist being categorized by the wizards of the state as an ethnic minority and to maintain their conditions of self-government. Even so, they relate self-government has not been the same as national independence or self-determination. As they write, apart from structural changes, there is no good solution to the question of self-government today. Indians have few viable options open to them because they lack the substantial economic and social freedom to experiment with alternative ways of doing things. Self-government is precisely superseded by the demand for self-determination.
Now, here's what's key. For Du Bois and Lytle, it is precisely self-determination that is necessary to develop and put into practice new knowledge, new systems, new ways of knowing, new ways of relating and being. And this is, to me, what, you know, when we dismiss nationalism, right, what we lose. There is an incredible imagination behind coming up with alternative ways of being. When we think about, you know, El Plan de Aslan, right, it's different ways of organizing work and production, different ways of educating us, right, different sets of social relationships. I think that's often forgotten, and it's vital to a working class movement, and that these were working class movements. Right? Let's not create a false binary. And I think they're important too, because if you think about some of the talks I've seen this week. You know, Bill Fletcher talked about racism as a herpes. Right? Just keep going on back. And this is sort of, you know, when I think about, when I explain to my students why nationalism is important, I think about Invisible Man, when Allison says at the end, hey man, just because a few people violated the principles doesn't mean the principles were bad. Well, you know, the black nationalists or the nationalists, well, they were at root. Right? To quote Charles Chestnut, right, the marrow of our tradition, right, there's a problem. You got to go back and overhaul the whole tradition. Right? And so it stands against sort of the dominant Americanism that, you know, Ellison's kind of Cold War novel, Cold War ideology. Recently, I guess it's not recently anymore, but Barbara Foley sort of in her work, Spectres of 1919, right, sees nationalism as, in fact, and the left's flirtations with nationalism as actually leading to the erosion of the left. That's what destroyed the left. I kind of would think the opposite, that it's been the left's inability to fully comprehend and engage with these politics that, and to see their compatibility with a necessity for a viable international class struggle, which, you know, has weakened the left. Leroy Jones said long ago, when he was Leroy Jones, in his work, Black as a Country, add nationalism to the list of dirty words, right, with communism, and if we, you know, I think about also what those politics give us, I think about just the importance of what we should call an internal third world perspective in the United States. When we think about the third world Marxist perspective, I think it really helps us understand class in a national and global way quite differently, and understand the way uneven and combined development works. You know, I was listening to Larry Cohen the other day. One of the last questions he got was, yeah, I remember the question, I remember the answer, but he was talking about, well, the way to stop immigration and to deal with these issues, or the immigration issues, is to get economies in the home country back on foot. Mexico should do what Brazil does. And you know, if we think about, you know, Walter Rodney or Samir Amin or these third worlders who sort of say, yeah, Marx is right about a lot, but, you know, I didn't fully understand the uneven development of capitalism, the periphery's not going to get developed, right? That's not how it works, right? When you think about colonialism. So, you know, I appreciate Larry Cohen's talk, but I'm not sure if that's the answer. That's sort of trying to get capitalism working in all countries. It's not helping us fully understand the way capitalism operates. In Moriyama's work, you know, as you might glean from the title, All I Ask For Is My Body, Moriyama's trying to provide some imagination, right? A representation of exploitation of what happens to workers' bodies. You know, how do we get liberated? How do we get this back? And what I want to start to look at is what are the layers of the socioeconomic and political system we need to address? How do we unwrap these systems to set free exploited bodies? Interestingly enough, this is the mantra of the oldest son in the Oyama family, Toshio, who was always asking his parents, because his parents had this enormous debt of like $6,000, and they make like $30 a month and have expenses of like $80 a month. They're never going to pay it back, but because of the cultural priority and filial piety, right, the children are expected to stay and work. And Toshio is very critical, says, what this filial piety, man, this is not working. We're not going to pay this debt. You're just taking my body. And a lot of critics have looked at this and said, yes, well, Moriyama's saying that, you know, they need to give up Japanese culture and move into the American system. You know, which is not true. I mean, Moriyama's pointing out, well, what we need to do is recognize that these Japanese traditions, as they get applied within a new capitalist context, these colonial situations, right, need to be advanced. You can't hang on to old traditions, you need to adapt. And Toshio is actually sort of is kind of the most character who does exemplify filial piety. He will never leave, right, unless he gets permission. He's always there in the collective, but he's always the one trying to escape. In this novel, Murayama borders his narrative around the trope of substitution, which I'll explain in a bit, in dramatizing the pitfalls of Asian American national consciousness. He introduces this theme in the second section of the novel. The novel's a wiry 100-page novel of three sections. The first two are very short. In the second section, which is titled The Substitute, it's narrated from the perspective of the youngest son in the Oyama family, Kiyoshi or Kiyo. And the idea of the substitute in their cultural tradition is that if something happens, if you can find someone else to take on your pain, you know, that's an okay thing to do in some sophisticated way. In this section, the mother falls ill after having her rotten teeth pulled. She has all her teeth pulled out because they're all rotten. And she gets very ill. By the end of the story, the grandmother of the Oyama family unexpectedly dies, and this is coupled with the mother's miraculous recovery, which lead the characters to read the events in terms of the lore of substitution, by which one can be saved by passing one's misfortune on to another, the substitute. We also see in the novel, however, that this substitution is not really an efficacious solution to the real causes of the mother's illness, poverty, malnutrition, etc., which are effects of the exploited life the family endures under the racial patriarchal capital system that's working on the sugarcane plantations. Indeed, the mother's decision to get false or substitute teeth at the end of the section points out the hollowness of substitution as a solution to her individual and family situation. Murayama extends the theme of substitution in the larger context of class dynamics in section 3, which bears the novel's title, All I Ask for is My Body. Here, the themes of substitution has explanatory power when applied to the colonial system on the plantation, to the extraction of surplus labor, surplus value from workers' bodies. Just as one's salvation is based on another's misfortune in the substitution in section 2, so in section 3, we see that profit is based on the worker's loss of his labor in the form of surplus value. In a discussion in Kiyoshi's class at school, the teacher, Mr. Snook, raises for the discussion the issue of the plantation hierarchy, he's later fired, criticizing it as efficient in the making of money and winning wars. When a student asks, what's wrong with making money? Snook replies, nothing. Barely everybody does it, preferably out of someone else's sweat or misfortune, making clear the processes of substitution under capitalism. One's exploitation is another's profit. The alternative to substitution also enters the classroom when Mr. Snook raises the issue of the Filipinos' worker strike against the plantation, to counter which many of the Japanese students have been brought in as scabs. Mr. Smith tells them, the plantation divides and rules, and you, the exploited, are perfectly happy to be divided and ruled. Do you see what I'm driving at? The Filipino strike, and you're all too happy to break the strike. It's a big deal. Doesn't it prick your conscience just a little bit? Don't you feel you're cutting off your own nose? Or do you feel your nose has nothing to do with your face? When a student answers that the strike gives them a chance to make money, Stick responds, the candidacy is done at another's expense. Haven't you heard I'm my brother's keeper? We hang together or we hang alone? Snook illuminates the process of substitution in which different Asian American national groups vie amongst each other at each other's expense instead of organizing in solidarity against the plantation. A sentiment Kiyo's older brother, Tosh, echoes later in the conversation with his parents. Tosh argues that the Japanese workers should have joined the Filipinos, while his parents held that the Filipinos were strike breakers in earlier strikes by Japanese workers, and that other people's business is none of theirs. It's our business too, Tosh replies. We fight the same plantation. And here you see this struggle over cultural tradition. Right? The path to solidarity for Tosh is complicated by the international situation, particularly Japan's bombing of Pearl Harbor. Tosh argues with his parents that you gain respect by fighting, you have to fight them. But first we must forget about returning to Japan. We have to cut off all our ties to Japan and become American. It's clear, however, in the novel that becoming American is not fully possible for the Japanese. That is, they will still be exploited and targeted for economic oppression because of their racial and national identity. As is made clear by Tosh's recognition that there are no other jobs than those on the plantation for the Japanese. And later, of course, we see Japanese being interned, and later in Plantation Boy, and it's very clear that those who work on the plantation prefer internment. Because the plantation needs them. Those on the mainland who own property are dispossessed and sent to camp, and then they go to war, and they come back, and they go back to camp. They are effectively a colonized labor force, right? This is a special labor situation. The novel figures in the recognition that the interests of the Japanese working class in Hawaii do not lie with the Japanese capitalist imperialist mission, nor with the U.S. colonial system, but rather with the formation of a pan-Asian American working class national consciousness. So the process of class formation, or working class formation specifically, is a process of racial and indeed nation formation. In this context, Moriyama represents the making of an Asian American identity as, in fact, the development of a radical class consciousness in this specific context. Right? The development of an anti-colonial consciousness which understands the specificity of the colonial experience of Asian American workers in Hawaii is key to understanding how class works in this context. The nation becomes the form of agency for working class liberation. Just quickly, in plantation boys, we move towards statehood in plantation boy, and as Japanese characters go to the mainland for their army training and stuff like that, they really begin to understand their colonial status and you get a clear sense of how class works. And one character writes back to Tosh, one of Tosh's friends, I like stateside when I can get out, things are so different. The Howleys here are working class. Waitresses, janitors, farmers, day laborers, etc. They're not only tough, but also hardworking. The plantation Howleys are colonists, actually, the white man's burden and all that. In fact, to the poor Indians I see around here, all America is a colony. So we see this articulated throughout the novel. Tosh still struggles to get out of the plantation. And in fact, many go to the army to get out of the plantation. And Tosh makes it, he takes drafting in a correspondence class. But he never become an architect. But he goes to work for the civil service. And his mantra is always, this is still the plantation, man. Right? Because there are still these limits on race. And they can never sort of achieve self-determination or any kind of ownership of their world. He works for an architect, and he can't get a license, so he does all the work of the architect. And the architect makes millions, and he makes nothing. But he still will go back to the plantation and say, look at all the money I make, man. But he misses the relationships and the solidarity on the plantations, and moreover, he recognizes he's got no health insurance, right? When his kids are getting sick, like, man, if they get sick, we're going to be broke. He says, that's one thing the union got him was health insurance. So he's starting to see the bankruptcy of the individual's narrative of mobility at the same time that he's committed to it, right? He's always asking for more money, right? Never quite asking for self-determination, right? It can't quite clicked in his head, and it's a brilliant character that Moriyama created, because he's a rebel, man. He's a badass. He's so, and you see things, you just can't get out of his mirror. And when we get to statehood, Tosh reflects on this. He says, many Hawaiians oppose statehood. I don't blame them. First, the Hawaii planters kicked out Lili Kalani and seized the government. Then they got Hawaii annexed in 1898 to protect American interests in the wake of the Spanish-American War. Statehood will be the final nail in the coffin. The colonials are here to stay, and us, their imported labor. So just to sum up quick, one thing I'm still thinking about, when I think about the indigenous nationalist movements in Hawaii, they root their politics in indigenous rights, and what I'm not quite sure of is how this fits with the Japanese and Filipino immigrants who espouse a kind of nationalism that's rooted not in indigenous rights, but in the fight for a different way of life, and kind of delinking from the colonial system. I'm not sure how those relate, so I need to get a grant to go to Hawaii. But what I do hope you take from this talk is we need to consider these directions for working class movements, right? What is a working class movement in specific contexts, right? Trying to get paid, but it's a fight for decolonization. So 12:15, which is a formal end of the session, but the panelists does not. That you want to apply right here and then.